serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating visit today with 104-year-old Jack Perrin of Santa Barbara, California. It's impossible to squeeze 104 years of life into an hour on the radio. What doesn't fit here we'll include in the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com. We've heard about his time as a UCLA student athlete, the secret naval intelligence work he did that, among other things, enabled the U.S. to set a trap for the Japanese at Midway and turn the tide in the Pacific War. But when World War II finally came to an end, Jack was ready to return home to California and go back to the paper towel dispenser business his stepfather had started after seeing a pile of wasted towels on the floor of an L.A. Coliseum men's room 15 years earlier. So, Jack, you went back to Towel Saver Incorporated, and it wasn't long until you were taking over the leadership role of that company from your dad.
I wanted to go back east, open up the eastern market, which I did, east of the Mississippi River. See, we had the three coast states we sold directly to distributors, which was Crown Zellerbach Company, and they sold that to the Midwest, to the Mississippi. And they had another company competing with us on the other side of the Mississippi River. We let them sell it and pay us a royalty because we couldn't afford to travel around and do all that. So we did. We did pretty well.
And just kind of following along that story a little bit, one little detail that jumped out at me that I think a lot of people forget about, because we talk about World War II and the 16 million Americans in uniform and all the folks back home doing their part, but just simple things like during World War II, those dispensers were made out of wood instead of metal. Is that right?
We had it was just a plain simple wood thing with a holder and all. It wasn't a real dispenser.
But the metal was needed for the war effort, so they weren't producing the metal dispensers during that time.
That's right. You couldn't do it.
But then you come back, and you're actually looking at a design from before the war that had never been completed, and you kind of made that your own, your baby? Was that the C-5, I think it said?
Yeah, that was my. They were going to throw those tools away.
The tools to make them in the factory?
Yeah, you have to get the tools to make the metal parts. Pretty big operation for a small company, but I made the dispensers.
So that became a new model of the Towel Saver?
Yes, I got one, and I used to have the lift the lever and turn the crank, and I changed it around to where you didn't do that. You just start to jiggle it and freeze it, and it'll turn. So you could turn it by just a hair breadth away from pulling back towards you. Well, the C-5 they were going to throw away. They made a dispenser. It was smaller and compact, but it had no lock on the front. Couldn't lock it. They were going to throw it away. I wouldn't let them do it. I'm South Sales Manager now down there. I thought we could use it. Sure enough, the big, awkward-looking dispenser we had before was outdated by this new one. So the new one went, and it worked fine. Of course, it had no lock on it. We didn't care. We made a sales pitch out of it. It didn't have a new lock, because the janitor had to get there in a hurry. Use that as an asset rather than a liability. But anyway, I did a good job, and I sold a hell of a lot of them.
And before long, you could find those C-5s in a lot of different places. And I bet you've probably even been a few places in recent years where you've stumbled across one or two and it puts a smile on your face. Do you have any stories like that where somewhere you've been and you realize, hey, they're still using one of my dispensers?
I'll tell you about one that surprises me. The big lake, Lake Crawley. You know where Lake Crawley is?
I don't think I do. Why don't you explain it for us?
Well, it's a great big lake right near Bishop.
Okay, yeah, on the eastern side of the Sierra. So you stumbled across a C-5 up there?
He had a dispenser. They have our early model with the lever, lift the lever and turn the crank, still in use. And the reason is that the state of California bought our towels, and we have provided all these cabinets to them. California had our cabinets all over, Towel Saver.
Talking about Crawley Lake and running into one of your early dispensers up there and the smile that put on your face.
It's still there, I think.
Still there in 2020. Well, there's another thing that's still there, although COVID-19 has put a crimp in it for now. But you are the man behind a fly fishing academy, a free fly fishing academy for kids at Silver Lake every year. Where did that come from? Why was that important for you?
Well, I wanted to teach the kids how to fly fish.
You're in your late 90s when you started this. Most people in their late 90s aren't starting anything. They're wondering if they're going to be able to finish something. It's just inspiring, I think, to hear about someone who has the vision to begin something like that, to pour into the lives of people much, much younger that's going to reap dividends for a long, long time. I imagine it's been fun for you to be around those young people.
The fellow that runs the camp there sets it up. We do a great job. We take all the young kids around 15, 16 years old. Like to get them around at age 14 to 15, better. And we teach them how to fly fish. We have a couple of instructors. A lot of people come and watch and help, and they help. We bring 18, I think, in. We have the guides, and the guys take them out fishing, and we supply the shoes, wading pants, and a helmet, and glasses for sure. We won't fish with them without glasses because they might get them in their eye. I know people get flies in their eye once in a while. So we watch it pretty carefully. It's my baby. I started it, and I just love it.
104 years is a long time to look back over. And there are a lot of things that you've been a part of, and we've heard just a few of them here today. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story that only you could tell us. When you reflect on 104 years, is there something that you are most proud of?
Oh, I would say that it's the thing I have for the kids. I'm the most proud of that. And it's very successful. Dad and parents are so happy to write me a nice letter. I'm happy they are. Their kids will get that. So it's a good deal. I'm very happy about it. Well, my first love is to set up something for these young kids.
So it's impossible to miss Jack's affinity for Silver Lake and what a legacy he has there with all the young people learning fly fishing skills as a result of his thinking and his generosity. And we're actually going to be joined by someone who's very familiar with Silver Lake, has been out on that lake with Jack Perrin. That is Dr. Don Goffinet, who joins us now, Navy veteran of the Vietnam War, a longtime oncologist and faculty member at Stanford University. Don, Jack at Silver Lake, how far back do you two go with the time spent together out there fishing?
We bought our cabin in 1989 and met Jack almost from the day we got it, and we've been friends ever since. Our aquatic adventure took place, I believe, on a very cold day in the end of May 2013, 7 years ago.
So you're out on the lake with a 97-year-old World War II veteran.
We were out in Jack's boat, and we'd been trolling. We caught a fair number of rainbow trout, and then we anchored about 50 yards offshore close to Jack's cabin. And then he wanted to start up and go in, but his motor wasn't working well. So I went from the bow to the stern and got the motor started and went back, and I just sat down at the bow when Jack, who is a big man, leaned over to pull up the anchor, and the next thing we knew, within a second, the boat was overturned, and we were in a cold, cold Silver Lake. And I didn't see Jack. It was very quiet, and a voice said, reach under the boat, which I did, and I felt some cloth, and I pulled hard, and up popped Jack. And we were able to stabilize him with one of the handholds on the stern of the boat, and then the motor shaft was sticking out, and he balanced on that. We were very fortunate that I had my red fleece fishing jacket on, and one of my arms was sticking out of the water, and Jack's wife, Kathy, saw the red jacket from her cabin. She notified two of our friends who came out with a boat and helped us get to shore. But it was quite an unexpected experience, and I'm very happy that we survived.
You know, I'm thinking about the number of gentlemen that I've had on this program telling their experiences from World War II when their ships would sink. We've had guys that, you know, were in the water for hours, if not days. We're right on top of the 75th anniversary of the USS Indianapolis sinking. A lot of those guys were in the water for 3-4 days.
Yeah.
And those guys were teenagers and in their 20s. Here you have a guy who's 97 and you in your 70s at the time. Were there some moments there where you guys didn't know if someone was going to find you?
Yeah, there was nobody on the lake, and the wind was blowing, was very cold. Jack wasn't going to be able to make it unassisted into shore, and I wasn't going to leave him. So I had just decided that we would either survive together or we would die there. And then fortunately, two of our friends, Roger Goetz and Jack Stark, came out, and Jack is a very big man, and so he could not get in the boat that came out, and he was towed to shore. I guess we were in the water about 20 minutes, shower and a little rest, he was perfectly normal. So we were very, very fortunate that his wife saw my red jacket sleeve, which basically saved us.
Wow. Well, and what a courageous choice that you made to stay with Jack. And I know you're not asking for kudos for that, but I think we can all hear it, that that was a decision you had to make and a risk you had to take. And I'm thinking about Jack being in the water and then, you know, clinging to the capsized hull, 97 years old. I mean, you're a doctor. You've treated patients in their 90s and those with conditions that, you know, were akin to being that old. How impressive was it to you that he could handle something like that and make it through that?
It was just amazing. He's a remarkable man and probably the best man that I've ever known. And we talked and we prayed, and Jack just got cold, but everything was functioning well. And by that time, Roger and Jack were towing us in, and Jack walked into his cabin and took a shower, and he was fine. We got a little hypothermia, but we weren't in the water that long, and we had heavy gear on, so we made it out, and we both did well.
And I don't want to be melodramatic. I'm just curious. How often do you think about that? Because I know you still frequent the lake. How often does that memory or that incident come back around in your mind?
Oh, it's frequent. There was a period of time when most people in this small place, Mono County, knew about it. And I would walk into the Silver Lake Resort, and the people at the counter would say, hi, Don, how's the water today? And they'd laugh, and a lot of people had fun at our expense for our aquatic expertise. But fortunately, it turned out well, and we have some unique memories of what we did.
And you haven't added aquatic adventures to the curriculum of the Fly Fishing Academy?
No. That was Jack's wonderful idea, and it's been a huge success. And that is thanks to Jack Perrin and his family.
Well, I hope we're hearing about those young people with that opportunity for a long time in the future. And I have to say thank you, Dr. Goffinette, for saving Jack's life, for risking your own to save his, and also for doing something else, because my conversation with him isn't the first time someone's recorded his World War II experiences. You actually did that, I guess, about a year ago. Why was that important to you to have some of that recorded, the stories that you had heard from him on the lake over the years?
Well, I knew that Jack is probably the last surviving member of the famous code-breaking team in Pearl Harbor. His boss was Joe Roquefort, who was one of the head spy masters in Pearl Harbor, and Jack made a major contribution to winning World War II, the Battle of Midway, and when Admiral Yamamoto was shot down in April of 1943. And I thought that ought to be preserved for posterity. I was actually quite young at the end of the war, but I do remember the war and the Doolittle Raid, and one thing stands out. There's a ghost town here called Bodie, which is the nicest, best-preserved ghost town in the country. A mining engineer and I were in Bodie on VJ Day, and that's almost 75 years ago now, and we were the only two there. I could go on, but the story got quite interesting, and when we were coming back to Silver Lake from Bodie, Stanley said, well, Don, the war's over. There's no more 35-mile-an-hour speed limit. Let's go back to Silver Lake at 100 miles an hour, and we did.
Driving what?
I don't remember. I don't remember the car yet. I was only 8 at the time. But we went down in a mine shaft. I found a box of dynamite in Bodie, and I picked one of the sticks up, and it had a little substance on the end that looked like honey. I brought it to Stanley, and I said, Stanley, this dynamite has some liquid honey on it. And he looked at me, and he said, put that down. That's nitroglycerin. Let's get out of here. We were lucky we got out of Bodie on August 15th, 1945.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of those wounded Marines in Vietnam are thankful you made it out of there, and all your patients at Stanford over the years that you made it out of there. And I've heard a lot of VJ Day stories on this program, the parties in New York City or San Francisco or D.C. and the ships at sea and people all over the world. I didn't think I'd ever hear one about the ghost town of Bodie. No way.
Well, VJ Day in Bodie was unique, and I'm going to go back there on August 15th in less than a month and just tell them I was there for the first time 75 years ago.
That's beautiful. Well, maybe if Jack can get out of his current situation, maybe he can join you there. Is there anything else that you think we all ought to know about Jack? Because you had some very kind words about him. It's clear that you think very highly of him. What is the thing that you find most impressive or most valuable about his life and his example?
He's just a wonderful, wonderful, balanced man. And he's cordial. He's honest. He's straightforward. He's great to be with. I've never met a better man than Jack Perrin. He's just a wonderful man, and there's nobody like him. I've never met anybody like Jack Perrin.
Again, that was Dr. Don Goffinet. And there's one more voice I want you to hear. It's another doctor, Tim Perrin, Jack's son. What do you think we ought to know about your dad, Tim?
He's just a great guy. What's impressed me about my dad is just he doesn't focus on himself, and he really doesn't get flustered at problems. I guess it's going through World War II that contributed to that, but when problems come up, his response is, okay, well, what are we going to do to fix it? But my dad is amazing at 104. I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and I've seen him go through quite a few medical procedures, and he's got a dozen specialists to take care of him. And he's just that way. He's just very matter-of-fact about it all. He has to go through major surgery or whatever he has to do. It's just, that's what you do. When he was up in his cabin 7 years ago, and the boat capsized, and the water was freezing, and they almost died, he was very content to just pass on at that time, say his goodbyes and move on. And he's just, I think that's amazing this day when you've got so many people that are so upset about everything, protesting and writing about everything and all the things you're not happy with. I really believe that the mind of a man plans his way and the Lord directs his steps. I take rest in that. But I would say that probably what bothered my dad the most was the separation when he was over there for 2.5 years after just getting married. How did he do that? And I think that was a real lesson for me because my parents had such a strong relationship, and I think that contributed to it. The absence makes the heart go fonder. He's just a very strong leader, and he's not influenced by what other people think. I don't want to say that the wrong way. He gets a lot of advice from a lot of people, but he doesn't hesitate to listen to what everybody has to say and then do something totally different. He really thinks for himself. I appreciate that. He's part of the greatest generation. I really believe that. When that movie, The Midway, came out last year, and we watched that, and I watched it with my dad, that was very powerful. It really made it real to me. You know, you hear these stories, and it sounds like, oh, long, long, long ago, and a time far away, whatever, you know. We lose track of history, and that's what I appreciate about having my dad around, he's 104, is being able to see history as relevant. That it really is relevant, and it really did happen. It wasn't just a story. It wasn't just a movie. We're going through our own problems right now, and I think being able to watch that movie gives a little perspective on our situation today.
Well, if you've spent the last hour with us, maybe your perspective is a little different from when we began. Thanks to Tim Perrin, Don Goffinet, and 104-year-old Jack Perrin. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.